This is Birth to Work Radio.
Try to convince a community that had always felt if you had a strong back, you could always make a decent living. That disappeared, but the same people stayed in the community.
The competition is much more prepared in terms of the knowledge base and the expectations, and we have to get there very, very quickly.
The problem with education in America is a problem of trying to use a bureaucratic form to do what is basically a cultural and moral mission.
It's important for business leaders to recognize they play an important role in the vibrancy of the community.
I always felt that as a pediatrician, I was also an educator because of the trust that people have in us.
We know that when parents know their children are in an academic crisis, they will move mountains.
The most important thing for parents to do is spend time in human interaction with children.
My goal as a community leader now is to create responsible, engaged citizens. I have to emulate what I want them to do.
And now, here's your hosts, Elaine V. Scott and Rick Stevens.
Hello, this is Elaine Scott, and my guest today is Suzanne Arms. How are you doing, Sue?
I'm just fine. It's really nice to be on the show.
You are, from the viewpoint of those of us on Birth to Work, as close to what I'm going to call a grassroots celebrity as we've had on the show. And you have been in my radar screen for some time, but no more appropriate time than right now, right here, right where we are today. One speaker's on the TED program on the internet called the Birth and Caring for Our Children as close to a valid green project as we could ever have. Taking care of our children and making sure we get things done right from the very beginning is a critical step going forward globally. And yet all too often in our culture, we have a place for children and the birth of children in our families that is not given the kind of consideration that we give picking someone to do plumbing in our house on one end. On the other hand, it can be so over-considered that someone has picked a date, a designer birth, a tummy tuck, a single cesarean, and it's all about a physical experience that is quick and easy and certainly not one that thinks about the engagement of the mother and child as what you call a whole system. I'd like this initial introduction to our audience to be one about your books and your materials. And like you, I share this 35-year commitment to something that we believe that's so fundamentally important to our culture that it must see a greater public awareness, or we risk literally losing a whole world of experience that can cost our culture very dearly. Would you talk a little bit about your work?
Sure. Oh, I was raised by two school teachers, my mother an English teacher of junior high kids and my father a history teacher of high school kids in an inner city ghetto. And I felt early on, maybe around the age of 10, that I wanted to make the world a safer place for children. I don't know why that came to me, but I think it had to do a lot with my upbringing. And then I went to college and I studied literature and anthropology, and I started out teaching nursery school and then becoming one of the first head teachers of a Head Start program in inner city San Francisco. And I didn't really give much thought to birth. In fact, it wasn't until I was pregnant with my daughter Molly, who was born in 1970, that really the idea of birth as an important thing came to me. My mother didn't tell me anything about my birth. As it turned out, she was a typical mom in those days, and she gave birth with twilight sleep. In other words, she was unconscious. When she came to, the nurse was holding her legs together and pushing my head back with every contraction because it was the doctor's night off, and he didn't want to come in. So I tend to go at things with my head. I saw birth as a woman's issue in the beginning, and it wasn't until she probably in the 1980s that I began to see that it was really about the baby. It was an issue about how we bring human beings into the world. And then in the end of the 90s, I began to realize it's really about the mother-baby system and the father-family bond and how that whole unit is secure or not secure in society. So it's been a journey for me to pick up along the way the scientific evidence that resonates with ancient knowing and underscores it and teaches us a lot more about brain development, nervous system development, and how to create resilient, thriving children and families. So that's where I am today. And I started a nonprofit about 10 years ago, and it's called Birthing the Future. And our role is to put on symposia, international symposia, and films. I'm just finishing a film that's going to go on PBS this next year to examine actually the process of birth in this country and what it is versus what it could be. And we do books and pamphlets and things that inspire people about the biological issues of how to create thriving human beings. In other words, what does biology say? So I guess that's my story in a nutshell, and I am a grandmother. I'm living in a three-generation household with my daughter and grandson, and he is now 15 and a half, so I'm getting to see a lot of it over again, the importance of how we rear children.
And the second time around, what does it look like to you with all the knowledge and background that you have about the significance of the birth?
Well, both the birth and the primal period itself, from preconception to age one, which is my sphere, during that period of time when the brain is undergoing its most rapid stage of development, what I'm seeing is an awful lot of insecurely bonded children. My grandson happens to be one who is pretty solidly grounded, but because of the nature of the birth that he had, a very natural birth, and the amount of in-arms time and breastfeeding and co-sleeping, he's a very independent, spirited child, but he also has a lot of empathy for people who have any kind of special needs. But what I'm seeing around him are children who are not so securely attached to their mother and father and not so secure in their own being and who are really totally taken up with the electronic age. And the amount of hours that they spend on the computer and cell phone is astronomical.
I want to come back to this conversation about the co-sleeping and what happens when children grow up as they mature. And my experience was the same as yours. I found that actually rendered me two very independent young women, not the opposite.
Right.
And yet it's one of those, I'm going to call it a myth that we're going to come back and look at, but I just wanted to make a comment about that. I found the same thing, and this is one of the things I want us to look at. But for just a minute, I want us to go back to the idea of birthing itself, because we talk about birth to work, and someone once said to me, well, we don't like birth, and we don't like work, so that's not a very good name for a, you know. And someone else said, well, birth to work, isn't that like what you do when you're going to have a baby? And I said, no, that would be work to birth. but the idea is that from that, what you call the pre-primal period, we're starting to see attention come to that area, very general attention. People are looking at that now and starting asking questions about the mother. But I don't think in her care and what she does, but I don't think anything has done as good a job as I've seen in a long time as this March of Dimes movie called Babies. Did you get a chance to see that?
You mean the one with four babies around the world?
Yes.
Yes. I saw it first in French, and then I saw it when it came here in English.
Well, since there was no language in it, I mean, no speaking in it, it universally communicated. Would you not say that?
Wonderful.
And did you have a sense when you were watching that, did you anticipate any feelings or emotions about watching these four infants going through the entire developmental process for that first year? And we got all the way to the end, and you saw the baby that was thriving the most was the one who had the least interference.
Right, right. It was an astounding film and beautifully done. I found the child that was born in the very cold reaches of Asia. Was that Mongolia?
Mongolia, yeah.
Where it was. That baby born by cesarean and then separated from the mother for 10, 12 hours, and then given to her after all of the creamy vernix that the body makes in the womb inside the mom to keep its skin from getting wrinkled, all having been washed off and wrapped up tightly swaddled for her to take home, I was shocked, because although she did, you know, she was going to be with that baby afterward, it was really clear that they had severely interfered with the bond between the mother and baby. And that made me very sad. Yeah, it was interesting that those who had physically the least in terms of money and what we would think of as a life of some comfort had the securest child. You know, I did want to say one thing, Elaine, that most people don't understand, and maybe we could start there and then people could remember this throughout the show, and that is, as a society that puts a great deal of stock in people being independent, we tend to think that early separation of babies and even cesarean birth and putting children to sleep in separate rooms is going to, and then putting them in early daycare is going to increase their sense of autonomy and independence, but it does exactly the opposite. The road to independence is by having our dependent needs met. In other words, our need for almost continual intimate contact in the first months of life. And for a mother having a slow-paced pregnancy and a natural birth and breastfeeding and all of the things that allow this child's natural biological rhythms and needs and paces to be matched and met are what create a thriving, independent child. And I think it's very important that we understand that that's a misconception, that isolation and separation and hyperstimulation in daycare and then in front of the television or computers is somehow going to get us the creative child who is able to be a fine adult, compassionate, hardworking, caring for others. It doesn't happen that way.
And I would agree with you. Very well said. But what I'd like to draw out from that, Suzanne, in terms of our listening audience, is just the very shock for most people that that even matters.
Right. Well, we have a notion that a baby is a product. We come from an industrialized view of things. The body is a machine and the baby is a product, and it doesn't matter how you get there. It's what you get at the end that matters. Now, it turns out that the process itself is extremely important because the process actually sets in motion the genetic potential. And the DNA is merely a blueprint. And our genetic potential is actually turned on, or switched on, altered, even completely changed by the environment that we start out in. And that first environment is conception to birth, that's the womb life, and then birth, and then that first year. This is the field of epigenetics. And it's only been for a few years that we've even understood at all that we are, you know, not a product of our genes, but our genes plus environment, with environment being far more important than we ever imagined. And so we have to look at the life of the mother and the state of the mother and the mother-father relationship and all of their support to see what's really going to happen to the architecture and circuitry of this baby's brain and nervous system.
Well, from the viewpoint of what we're talking about, and for our audience, I want to emphasize that what you and I share is an absolute certainty that the mother-child-father support relationship, with the infusion of that energy into the community and the receipt back to that family from the community, in other words, the exchange that goes on, is essentially what drives the development of a thriving, capable child.
That's right. And our families have gotten smaller and smaller, which has made the relationship of the mother and baby even more significant. If you are in a village society or a tribal society, the entire group would act as the mother-father or the matrix. And it wouldn't be as significant what the attitudes, feelings, and pace and level of stress of the mother was. But it becomes really important in a nuclear family society, which is actually not the way nature designed it. Nature designs it for there to be a whole circle around this mother-baby, the father, family, and then the community, the extended family, the neighborhood, and so on. So we're already looking at a fairly dysfunctional system. And when I'm looking at the mother-baby as a whole biological system, I'm looking at what can we do to stress it and interfere with it the least and support it the most so that it can thrive. Because if that unit thrives, then society has a much greater chance of thriving. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And what I want to add to that, though, is that it's not just a what I'm going to call a biological function. It's a biological function accompanied by a physical relationship, a movement relationship that in many cultures around the world, especially the Western cultures, they are limiting more and more and more the movement of the child.
Right.
And we've talked about this in other shows, but we've never had the benefit of talking with someone who also understands that emotional connection. And I think that what was important and stated very clearly with no words at all in babies, and I stay with this because it's something people can get on Netflix or, uh-huh. or they can go look at it and really see what we're talking about, is that the baby that ended up being the one that thrived the most was the one who dug things out of the dirt and drank from water on the ground. And it made such a startling statement about maybe we're measuring the wrong things when we look to what a thriving kid is like or a child is like.
That baby spent most of its first year on somebody's body, being rocked and moved and swayed as that body moved, listening to the voices but not having to attend to them fully. So that baby had the benefit of a lot of what I call passive stimulation, not the kind of stimulation that parents tend to do when they return home from work exhausted and then hyperstimulate the baby, but the kind that happens when the baby is being worn in a pouch, in a sling, and it can turn away from the outer world toward the mother's body or the auntie or whoever is carrying the baby, or it can turn and look out, and it can take in what it needs to during its brain spurts as it's going through these periods of brain development in the first year, and then it can have downtime. Our children today have very little downtime.
So let's talk about that brain growth and development when we come back. I want to bring us back in and pick up a very specific thread now, Suzanne. I want you to work with me on this. And I want you to start with the very moment of birth. And I want to talk about the brain development and the things that happens to the brain, because right now we are seeing our culture not just an epidemic, but a tsunami of problems all throughout the United States and in Western countries with so-called mental illness with children. And there seems to be this incredible disbelief, what's causing it, no one seems to know. And yet the people we work with at the Institutes for the Achievement of Human Potential in Winmore, Pennsylvania, they actually put all of these things, ADD, ADHD, autism, they put it all in the same envelope. And they said they're basically the same kind of process.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who truly work directly with children on a wellness and hurt brain basis, they see things differently than people who only see them come and go out of their office.
Right.
So it's not a criticism, but it's an observation. You have worked directly with the child, directly with the mother. You've seen what happens. You know what happens, but you're also able to give a description of it. Would you start at the very, very beginning moment and talk about the benefit of just letting nature do what she does and birth that baby?
I think it's important to understand that birth is a huge learning spurt for the baby. When it moves out of the womb, comes into the world, and actually leaves the mother's body, what has to happen is all kinds of systems in its body have to change so that it moves from a water being that's tethered to the mothership to an air-breathing being that has to be establishing its own temperature, find its food source, regulate its own body. And what creates this ability is the stimulation of labor, the stimulation of the contractions of labor and the baby being squeezed down the birth canal in this rhythmic way, which actually is like a massage to the entire nervous system and spine. What we see when babies are artificially induced or have had their labor speeded up, the mother's labor been speeded up with oxytocin, which is an artificial form of natural oxytocin that her body produces, or whether she's had sedation or anesthesia called epidural, is that the baby does not get the benefit of the hormones that flood the body, both its body and the mother's body, with the natural process. So we see in a lot of babies that are born in non-biologically normal ways an inability to move through space in an easy way. They're not really inhabiting their body in space. And so a lot of remedial work is having to be done on these children because they don't have a sense of space. They, for many of them, they had birth by cesarean without any benefit of labor at all. This has become a really big topic today, and often on the due date or 2 weeks before, which leads to lots of problems with what we call late premature babies, which sounds like it's not much, but it's actually huge because so much development occurs in the last weeks of gestation, and it's the baby that times this onset of labor. So when the baby first comes into the world, emerges from the mother's body, it's this huge aha and this huge learning spurt. And if that baby then goes directly into the mother's arms and the mother, baby, and father are allowed the privacy that they need to connect deeply with this baby, and anything that needs to be done is done on her body, if they're not separated, then they remain one system. Then the milk comes in, the breastfeeding actually starts easily, her womb contracts easily. We don't know, for example, most of us, that when the baby merely nuzzles at the mother's breast, 19 different hormones are released in her gut that completely help her in her health and that help her be calm and deal with a baby who may not yet be used to its body and actually be uncomfortable and be crying. It helps her lose weight quickly. It has myriad effects. We also don't know that breastfeeding, that the formulation of breast milk changes from day to day and feed to feed depending on the actual needs of that specific baby, because the mother and baby are one system. We don't realize that when the mother has a cold or there's any kind of virus in the air, the baby gets it through the breast milk and then actually injects it into her breast, and then the breast makes the formula in the breast milk that is needed to counteract that virus. So it's an exquisite series of processes that we see from conception through the first hours even after birth, but we tend not to think about them because we are looking at this baby as a product. And so we immediately separate the baby to be washed, to be cleaned, to be examined. All of these things disrupt the bond. And that bond is critical to the baby's not just survival, but emotional well-being. It's what nurtures the ancient brain so that the baby has a feeling of calm and a sense that all is well. And without that touch and rocking and soothing sounds and being within 3 feet of the human heart virtually every minute of the day for weeks and months, that baby does not have all that it needs in terms of brain development. And the other thing I did want to mention is that we now know in cellular biology that cells grow in a binary way. They either develop fully or they develop in a state of defense. And when the information that the cell receives, which means the organs receive, including every organ of our body receives, feels to the cell to be threatening, it will shut down and it will wall itself off in a state of defense. And you cannot grow fully in a state of defense. So everything that we're talking about here is actually biologically sound information from the last 20, 30 years. But it also is common sense. It also really touches what our gut and our heart would say. You pick up the baby when it cries, or even before it cries. We have a whole new category of crying that we've actually identified now in child development called, let me get to that in a second. It's when a baby has to cry and cry before someone will pick it up. Say it's sleeping in another room, mom has to wake up, dad has to wake up, go across the hall, there's a baby monitor, so they hear the sound, has to go and pick up the baby when it cries. This cry is called protest despair. And what we are seeing in this country is more and more insecurely attached children. And along with that, we are seeing children who carry a great deal of shock and trauma from the high levels of stress that women have experienced working right up to the end of pregnancy, not thinking a lot about their own pregnancy because their attention is on where they're going to put the baby in daycare in order to get back to work immediately afterwards. They're starting to disconnect before they've even fully bonded. So we just see disruption after disruption, intervention, and overwhelm to the baby. And when we talk about trauma at this stage of life, we're talking about something that is overwhelming to the nervous system, that involves pain, and that pain can be psychic or physical. It can be the pain of being in the intensive care nursery from all of the poking and prodding and the shots. It can be the psychological pain of being separated from the mother. But it's also the third piece is a sense of helplessness and the inability to escape this overwhelming set of sensations.
Let me just take that body of data now and let me put it in a context outside of the human baby.
Mm-hmm.
If we saw any other animal do to its young what we do to ours, what was our response? If we saw a mother bear take her baby, or we saw any other animal, a leopard or an elephant, if they were to do to their infants what we do to ours, we would think them mad.
That's right.
And yet we accept it for some reason as if there's some kind of an okayness about somebody using some sort of scientific process, you know, to stand in the way of the mother and the child. And I find that most interesting when I think about the number of times we claim, well, what if something happens? And yet out of our ignorance or lack of awareness or something, you call it lack of common sense. I remember when I had my girls, my doctor said, we do episiotomies in this country 97% of the time. And in Europe, they do them 3% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor said, I know where the baby comes from. It just takes time. You have to know how to make it safe for the baby to come out. But again, we don't ask those questions. The common literature, the public literature, the ordinary things that people read don't seem to go into that much detail. They don't seem to give that much information. And yet you've worked relentlessly on this topic, and you're pointing out a lot of the things that we're seeing now in kids are things we don't understand, but we don't go far enough back with our questioning to ask, where did they begin? Other than in some sort of chemical cesspools that the toxicities and things that kids are exposed to. But where was the upside? Where was the good stuff?
Right.
It wasn't there.
Well, you know, one of the problems is that we have a pathological level of fear of birth, not just women, men who are partnered to those women, and also people working in birth itself, nurses and physicians in particular. And by the time many midwives get through university training and medical departments, they also have a healthy, unhealthy disrespect for the process itself. And so the fear, it's fear that drives so much of what we're doing, and a lack of understanding of what the normal physiological process actually offers. The assumption is that it's a bad process, it was poorly designed, and that anything that we can do, we should do. You know, when I was a Head Start teacher, we saw about one or two insecurely attached or children with attachment disorders in each classroom. Head Start today sees about 80%, that's the figure I was given, 80% of their children having attachment disorders. And they have said that the research is now showing that 70% of the general public has attachment disorders. But on part of the attachment disorder is the inability to orient itself in space and feel safe in its own body and to trust the people who are caring for it. For many years, we actually thought in the United States that trust was the first developmental task that a child had. This is what a baby learned first, was trust. It turns out that actually babies are born with trust. They don't have to learn it. It's when trust is betrayed because their little system is overwhelmed with shocking experiences that they cannot identify and deal with, that we actually have problems. Now, this is on top of the fact that we've got a lot of environmental stresses to deal with today. When we're talking about ADD, ADHD, autism, and many of the other learning disabilities and behavioral problems that children have, we have to figure in that we've got a much more toxic environment, which means it's even more important that the baby's biological, physiological bonding needs get met right from the beginning, and that the mother is in as low a state of stress as possible and as great a state of ease as possible, both in pregnancy and also after birth. There was a study done in Florida, a sampling of 10 babies from different nurseries examining their cord blood, and they found on the average of those 10 babies 187 man-made chemicals. Now, I was sitting on an airplane the other day talking to a chemical engineer, and I chatted. He wanted to know what I did, and I told him about my work with birth and bonding and the importance of making thriving children so that they are capable of being fully functioning adults. And I said that I told him about this study, and he said, well, I suppose you're going to say that that there's something wrong with this, that these are bad. And I had to think for a moment how to deal with his question without putting him off. What I said was, actually, it's not that man-made chemicals are bad things. It's that the human body at the beginning of life doesn't know what to do with them. It cannot use them. Its systems are immature, and so it stores them in the cells, in the brain, in the liver, and hopes to be able to deal with it at a future time, where these same chemicals might leave a mother's body within hours or weeks. So we're dealing with an organism, a human baby, that while it is fully sensitive and aware and conscious, is inhabiting a body that is actually biologically born prematurely. If you compare it to any other large mammal, it takes a human infant almost a year to get to the stage that most large animals, like a foal or a calf, or goat, gets to within 24 hours. The ability to get up on its feet, to follow the food source, and to flee from danger. So it's a paradoxical thing that we have here, that our human babies are born physiologically immature. They need 9 months after they come out of the womb to actually fulfill their development, and that development is best done in arms, worn against the body, co-sleeping, which means just sleeping within 3 feet of a human heart, can be It doesn't even have to be in the same bed, but in a little cot next to the bed. And this promotes the mother-baby and father-family bond that is so crucial, upon which this child's life depends. To protect.
Well, let's talk about that, though, Suzanne. What you've presented seems like a significant accumulation of information, data, knowledge, background, in the same way that I've worked on this, on the phenomenon of movement for the child and the developing brain, and the way that we have used strollers and buggies and all sorts of devices to separate ourselves from our children.
Right.
And carry them around in these little baskets, and then we wonder why, you know, the brain doesn't develop. And we know that if the child doesn't move, the brain doesn't grow. I mean, just it becomes
right.
stagnant. And yet we seem to shy away from asking questions or don't know how to even ask questions about this. So when we come back, Suzanne, I want us to go through some opportunities. I want us to talk about as many different kinds of opportunities that you can think of and that you have found that worked, that I have found that worked. And let's leave our audience with a sense of possibility about how to ask questions, who to go look for, and what to do with this desire to know more, but not to be feeling stupid.
Okay?
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce by Rick Stevens and Elaine Scott is winning accolades as an accessible business novel with a striking new perspective about community collaboration and workforce development for the 21st century. In the book, community leaders in the fictional town of Chantilly learn why they must think and act differently to build a sustainable workforce for the future. Real stakeholder leaders from around the country have used the book as a model for their own communities. Vicki Hogan is president and CEO of the Vermilion Advantage in Danville, Illinois. She and the Vermilion team have been collaborating with Birth to Work to implement the strategies outlined in the system.
Your book is really incredible. It's like a roadmap that in story form really sheds the light on a national issue and makes it obvious in a story form who the key stakeholders really have to be to create sustainability.
Sustainable results will only come from collaboration, alignment, and integration of the people, programs, and ideas of a unified community. The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, shines a light on the challenges that communities across the country are facing right now and the forces that drive and influence people's behaviors. Stakeholder leaders such as Angela Phillips Diaz are using the book as a guide for effective stakeholder action. In her work with the University of California, Riverside, she's charged with improving the college-going rate in the region.
I literally have the book on my desk and use it as a reference tool all the time. It's been invaluable to me.
The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, is the guide for stakeholder leaders who want to do business as usual in a new way. Buy it today at birthtowork.org or amazon.com.
This is a fantastically exciting interview. I'm with Suzanne Arms, author of one of the most popular books, or well thought of and respected books, called Immaculate Deception. She and I are talking about the phenomenon of what happens naturally, biochemically, and emotionally when mother and baby are left to their own devices to be together, the kind of chemistry that ensues, the healing that ensues, and the emotional stability that is the natural birthright of the child is realized when the two can act as a single unit. But all too often, the experience is corrupted, it's interfered with, it's dismissed, and favor is paid to the whole idea of a scientific process of how we go ahead and inject the mother or relieve her of any of the pain, or the baby is whisked away and treated as if it were some sort of object that she delivered and now becomes a toy for her to play with. And the angst over all of that is that we're seeing multiple combinations of problems with young people today, with kids, with mental illness in four-year-olds being one of the dominant reasons why health programs in Illinois are struggling, because they have an epidemic of kids who are struggling that young. And I think as a nation, it may be a little harsh, but I think we should be ashamed of ourselves. We should be looking at this not from the viewpoint of trying to fix a symptom, but really looking at root cause, and that means going back to the moment that we even think about having a child and respecting that moving forward. But all too often, it's difficult. It's difficult to find people to talk to. It's difficult to even know how to broach the subject. And I know your book is considered a landmark and the Immaculate Deception, but is that a good place to start, Suzanne? Are there other books and materials? Are there other things that parents can do? Are people who are thinking about having a baby?
That people need to do when they consider pregnancy is get themselves as healthy as possible and realize that their level of health is going to affect the level of their baby, whether they are smoking, whether they're eating a fresh diet, whether they're drinking, whether they're getting enough sleep and rest. These things need to be looked at, as well as their lifestyle in terms of how much work they want to do over the next months and how they can cut back and simplify their lives in order to actually have a lower stress pregnancy. The second thing I would suggest is that people actually go and seek a midwife and get an exam from a midwife and a history from a midwife, which is usually an hour long, rather than a six-minute prenatal visit with an obstetrician, because most women never need to see an obstetrician. It's very rare for a woman actually to need the services of an obstetrician who's a specialist in complications and in drugs and surgery. So the first thing I would do is look at how to simplify our lives, look at how to lower the stress, look at how to increase the quality of what we take into our body, and then seek a midwife, and then look at how we're going to arrange our work schedule so that a woman can actually
be available
for months and months in pregnancy. It would behoove all of us to have long maternity leave. We're the only Western country in the world that does not have fully paid maternity leave, and of course not any paternity leave, and yet that's what we really need for mothers and fathers to bond fully with their children and to be able to be healthy when they go back into the workforce, because their children are healthy, their babies are healthy. The next thing is to actually dispense with as much of the fear of birth as we possibly can, which means birth classes. It means, yes, people could go onto my site, birthingthefuture.org. They could also, there are numbers of books out there, but I think the most important thing is to get in a rhythm in their own life of exercise, rest, sleep, love, calm, good food that is conducive to nurturing the cells and the brain and the nervous system of this growing child inside, and to look toward afterbirth to see how we can create for ourselves a time of at least 6 to 9 months where we can be with this baby, and particularly the mother, where childcare doesn't have to start, where we don't have to be separated from the baby for more than an hour or two at a time, and to look at who our community is, who our community of support is. If the mother-baby is looked at as one biological system, which is what it is, then in the hospitals, we will automatically change from ICUs to intensive care units for small and stressed babies to mother-baby units. We would never separate a mother of a premature infant from her baby. We would nurse them together and care for them as one unit. We would close all of the well baby nurseries. So people need to start thinking about where they want to birth, whether they want to birth in a hospital, in a birthing center, or at home. And research shows that birth centers and home birth are perfectly safe in terms of relative safety with regard to the hospital. They are safe or safer than hospitals for the healthy woman, for the woman who enters labor in excellent health. We also have to look at those mothers and babies who've had shock and trauma in pregnancy and birth or afterwards, and what we can do then. And we can use chiropractic care. We can use craniosacral care. We can do infant massage. If every parent learned infant massage, it would be enormously helpful. We could plan to breastfeed, plan to wear our babies. And those things also innately reduce stress and actually heal much trauma, because babies' bodies innately know how to heal. And a lot of times they just need a little bit of help. Homeopathic remedies is another place to look, especially if a baby has been separated from the mother after birth or has had a very stressful labor, or the mother has had a stressful labor. So I've looked at chiropractic, cranial sacral, homeopathic, and then infant massage, which parents can learn, co-sleeping, wearing babies, you know, lowering the stress after birth to see how many people can help the family so that they don't have to do so much of the detailed care of going shopping and cleaning the house, but they can just be with the baby for 30 days.
Let me stretch the rubber band here just a little bit. Those were all very helpful, and I'm glad we're going to be able to transcribe this and make this available to our audience because that's the sort of thing they enjoy. But there's another tool, a kind of mindset that has to do with getting your mind prepared to go against the grain.
Right.
When people around you are thinking that you are four cells shy of being a complete idiot because you're going to do these things, there's something that you have to be able to draw on inside of you, or a way of looking at this that says, I'm doing this because this is the best thing I can think of to do for my baby, but I'm also doing this because it makes a difference to our community at large. And our data about the trauma that kids are going through, is this deterring anyone from continuing the path that they're on?
Once you tell women that they don't know enough to birth normally and they have to go to an expert outside themselves, and they already are very frightened by what they see and what they hear all around them and on television and in films, then they're already exteriorizing their sense of authority and expecting another human being to tell them what to do. So if a mother-in-law says, you're going to pick up that baby every time it cries, you're going to spoil that baby, they're very likely to listen to it. But their own gut says, of course I would pick up a baby when it cries. That's how it communicates. Wouldn't I want to be picked up when I'm crying? So yes, part of it means stepping out of the cultural mindset. Part of it means turning off the television and the news during pregnancy so that you don't fill yourself with more fear and anxiety and bad news. Part of it means starting to associate with people who are actually looking at doing natural birth, home birth, birth centers, getting a doula to help in labor, especially if a woman chooses to or for some reason has to go to the hospital, so that she and her husband or her partner can be protected and supported by somebody who is there to do that, and they can do the job of laboring together. Birth classes are absolutely crucial, and only 20% of the women in this country think that it's important to prepare to have a baby or to get any education. A lot of them feel that they can get it online.
Yes, I was just going to say, lots of people think, oh, well, I'll just glance through and see how it's done online. I took birth classes at the YMCA. You know,
uh-huh.
I mean, we had birth classes all over the community, and this was when kind of the Lamaze period when it was sort of really catching on. And I was fascinated by the fact that it was not considered a medical issue that I had to go to the hospital for. And it was so exciting. I don't think I've seen classes there anymore.
I tell people, go to an independent childbirth educator. Do not take your classes at a hospital, because in the hospital classes, people are educated or trained to be docile patients. They're trained to accept what the hospital offers. It's quite natural, especially if the hospital is paying the birth educator. And that started way back in the early 70s when American hospitals realized that there was money to be made from doing birth education, because birth education had sprung up around the country as independent teachers were doing it. And they discovered that it was much smarter to bring people into the hospital, give them free classes, have an anesthesiologist come to one of the classes and talk about the epidural and how soon they can get it. Have an obstetrician come and talk about the cesarean, because then they will end up with people who are more compliant patients. So people need to really look at where they're getting information from.
Consider the source.
I don't necessarily recommend that people read tons of books. It's more that they get in touch with their own body and connect with this life inside them, and with their intuition, and with themselves and each other as a couple, to really make sure that their values are solid for how they want this child to be cared for, and to go to birth knowing that they are responsible for this baby. Most people don't know that when a baby is out of their arms in a hospital, the baby actually legally belongs to the hospital, and the hospital can do anything it wants. It is a ward of the hospital. So, you know, a lot of times there'll be a birth and then baby is sent to the nursery. Well, why is it sent to the nursery? Anything that needed to be done could be done right on the mother's body. But dad will want to stay with the mom. Nobody's going with the baby. So once you separate the mother and baby, you've really got them. And I think it's very important for people to understand that the system is not designed for natural, normal birth. It's not designed for breastfeeding. It's not designed for in-arms, strong bonding. It is designed for isolation, separation, hyperstimulation, and maternal deprivation. That's what it's designed for. That's, you know, I remember an obstetrician in the 70s from Canada saying, a society gets the birth that it deserves and wants. And our society, for many decades, has wanted a mobile workforce that could move from job to job and place to place without feeling any sense of loss. That's a sense of detachment. And to get people like that, we unconsciously have moved toward a way of birth that is artificial, artificial feeding, artificial infant care, and detached. And the more natural the birth is, the more bonded the mother and father are to this baby, and the less likely they are to listen to outside so-called experts who can't prove what they're saying. Really, the proof needs to be for anyone who wants to isolate or separate the baby from the mother and the father to actually prove it. For anybody who wants to artificially induce labor, to prove it. Textbooks show, obstetric textbooks still show, that normal gestation goes until 42 and a half weeks. And yet, all across the country, doctors are inducing women or doing planned cesareans at 39 or 40 weeks. This is insane. But if you have a population of women who are terrified of birth, they will listen. So I think the most important thing is for every couple to lower their level of fear. The film that I did, Giving Birth, which is on my website, Giving Birth Challenges and Choices, is what it used to be called. It's just Giving Birth on DVD, really shows the difference between the biological or midwife model of care and the medical model of care. And I use obstetricians speaking on behalf of normal, natural birth, and a labor and delivery nurse talking about why we don't need epidurals and the importance of not having an epidural, but allowing the mother's own hormones to flood her body and to make it possible to have this birth spontaneously and take the edge off contractions so that she doesn't need pain relief. It's called Giving Birth, and it's on birthingthefuture.org. And there are other films out there that will inspire people, but I'd say stay away from bad news. Keep a protective bubble around yourself. When anybody wants to tell you their bad birth story, stop them. This is not a time to increase the level of fear. We already have so much fear in this society. And anyone listening who is a grandparent or an elder or an auntie or an uncle has a tremendous role to play in nurturing this couple and nurturing this mother-baby by giving them the kind of support that they need, paying for their birth classes, making it possible for them to stay home with the baby for weeks and weeks after birth, arranging that all the meals will be done, prepared by neighbors and friends so that the couple can be together, cloistered and sequestered in a cocoon with this little baby in the days and weeks after birth for at least 30 days. So there's many things that people can do. And,
so let me.
It's just recognizing how important it is.
I'm at one with you on the argument. I firmly believe that what you're saying is exactly correct. Although I must admit I was guilty of giving birth to my second daughter at 5 in the morning and dropping off my other daughter at 9 o'clock at school. But, you know, it wasn't with malice. The issue is one of the principles that you talk about are principles that are crucial to the well-being of children, so that by the time they're 3 or 4 years old, they've reached that state of maturity and capability that is different than what they have today. And right. When I see that as I'm listening to you, I'm hearing the same admonitions for parents saying, want your baby and let your baby know you want your baby and plan so that you can be with that baby, even if it's just with intention and you have to be gone or you have to do something. Be with that baby with intention, because they know. They know that they are wanted, and they know that you respect them and that you want to be there with them. There's a beautiful book out called How Smart Is Your Baby by Janet Doman and Glenn Doman at the Institutes, mm-hmm. and they talk at length about the opportunity that parents have to really observe. They teach you how to observe your child. And I think what you're talking about is now how to, the whole couple should observe itself. Pay attention.
Listening and talking and telling the truth to the baby is so important, because babies understand.
And they know, and they get it.
Yes.
And I'm not sure I have enjoyed a call more than this call, and the opportunity to get one of the greats, one of the icons in our country on this subject, to share with my audience. You can get to know more about what Suzanne does at www.birthingthefuture.org. And you can know more of and hear her show, come back and listen to it at www.birthtowork.org. Thank you, Suzanne Arms. What a pleasure. What a delight. And folks, we'll be back next week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on Birth to Work Radio. For more information about Birth to Work, to stream or download podcasts of archived radio programs, or to purchase a hard copy or downloadable version of Rick and Elaine's book, The System, Igniting the Soul of Commerce, please visit our website at birthtowork.org. That's birth, the number two, work.org. We invite you to send us your feedback and questions directly by emailing info@birthtowork.org. Birth to Work Radio, the voice of community stakeholder leaders.